This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen, in for Terry Gross. The career of poet Myra Shapiro offers hope to people who tell themselves that they'll really start doing what they want to do with their lives after they retire. Born in the Bronx, Shapiro returned to New York in her 50s after raising a family and working as a teacher down south. In New York, she began writing and eventually publishing her poems. Shapiro's first book of poetry, I'll See You Thursday, was published in 1996. Recently, she talked with Fresh Air book critic Maureen Carrigan.
When I knew you only as my friend Carol's Aunt Myra, the thing that fascinated me about you was your decision to make a radical change in your life by moving to New York and becoming a poet rather late in life.
Yes.
But let's begin at the beginning. Like a lot of wonderful poets and writers, you were born in the Bronx. What kind of impression did those early years in the Bronx make on you?
Well, I feel that we are the product of the time and place we're born to. We're also who we are, we're shaped by the culture we're born to. And in the Bronx, I was born into a political family. It was during the Depression. I was a first-generation American. And what I felt, something that stays with me through now, probably all of my life will, is this sense, this feeling of hope that we take responsibility and we can make the world a better place. That was life to me. From my bed, I heard it.
When you say that you can make the world a better place, what were your parents active in? Were they socialists?
Well, this was my extended family. Mm-hmm. We lived several generations in one house. The center of our family was my aunt, my Tante Annie, and her husband, their two children, my cousin Sophie, to whom the book is dedicated, who always knows what side she's on. That was considered a great virtue. And then their children. We would show up at the house sometimes in the middle of the night. My parents were just struggling, my father trying to make a living. And it was this other house that I thought of as my family along with my mother and father. I didn't really make the separation. And it was socialism, Marxism, whatever it was called at the time. I was a child. I just knew there were meetings, there were rallies, there were songs, there were jokes. There was lots of food on the table. I mean, tea, constantly cups of tea. People were coming. And what there wasn't much of was quiet.
One of the poems in your volume, I'll See You Thursday, is called Family Jokes.
Yes.
And when I read that poem the first time, it really struck a chord in me. It also reminded me of so many other autobiographies and autobiographical writings written by first-generation Americans recalling their family and almost the coping mechanism of humor that their family relied on to make it in this country. I wonder if you would read that poem for us.
I'd be glad to. It starts with an epigraph from Genesis. I'll just say a little bit about that. It always struck me that so early in the Bible, this is Genesis 21, it's Sarah who says, "He hath made me to laugh so that all who hear will laugh with me." And I thought it was just, I think it's just wonderful that we have an attention paid to laughter in the Bible. And I think it's especially wonderful because Family Jokes comes from a time when I was very, very young. And I think that hearing laughter in the next room was what was important to me. I was totally confused by the jokes I heard, and only now as an adult that I've asked members of the family to help me recall them. Do I get the punchline? But laughter, laughter. Mm. Family Jokes. They always liked a good joke, even a bad one. The one about the 80-year-old man who takes a young wife. A fatal marriage, his neighbor warns. Fatal schmadel, he replies. If she dies, I'll take another. Jokes are what they had, my folks, who scared me so with troubles and loud arguments. In the middle of my mother's unfulfilled desires, my father's failures, working day and night to make a living, you call this living? Came the joke. The breather, the sun to warm us. The moon was sex, a mystery you needed to deflect by making light. A young man asks a young girl if she'd like to take a walk in Prospect Park, and then he's getting fresh with her. She protests. What do you think I am, a prostitute? He says, who's talking about money? They laughed. Immigrants, they bundled loss. I don't know when my mother coupled sorrow with sweet impudence to coin her favorite exit line. If I live and be well, I'll see you tomorrow. If not, I'll see you Thursday.
That's a wonderful line. Is that your mother's own line, do you think? Or is that?
Yes. Yes, yes, she always said that. And of course, we heard it so often. I can remember thinking corny. I can remember rolling my eyes. And in fact, when she was dying, she was ill for a period of months, I remember catching myself when she started to say it and she couldn't and I couldn't complete it. And that's another story.
Right. I think you catch some of that impudence and the ruefulness and the tragedy and the humor. One of the things I love about your collection is that it does seem to wed so many different emotions together, as your title suggests. Mm-hmm. I'll see you Thursday. Another thing that you wed in your poetry and in your speaking voice, and I think listeners can hear this, are the accents of the Bronx and yes. and of down south, where you lived for 45 years. How did that happen? How did a Russian-Jewish immigrant family living in the Bronx make it down south?
My father took a job managing a chenille bedspread factory in this little town, Dalton, Georgia, which was the bedspread center of the world. That was what the sign said when you entered. And so we moved when I was in third grade. And I thought it was another country because the language was different and because I came to realize I had to be different myself, different ways of playing, different food on the table, not so much in my house, but with friends.
And you were 9 years old. As hard as that transition must have been for you, I wonder about your mother, because I imagine your father was going out to work and you were playing with other children. What was it like for a woman of your mother's generation to move from the Bronx down south? Was she happy with the move?
Do you know? No one ever asked me that before. And so if I were home alone right now, it might touch off another poem. My mother, what would it have been for her? I don't know. The only thing that I sense is that life was not as chaotic because my father had a steady job, because we had a house, our own house, and she wasn't part of this extended family, and maybe that could have been more peaceful. She probably missed them. But the fact of a household that's your own and that has a degree of certainty may have brought a measure of peace that she needed. I don't know.
Did she and your father seek out other Jews down south?
That's what happened.
How did they make a home for themselves?
That's what happens, in fact. in small towns, I know in the South, maybe all over, that even when people are not part of an organized religion, let's say, in larger cities where they can satisfy all kinds of things within themselves, the community in the South, especially at that time, tended to put you in a certain place, and that's where then you found your own. Mm. In this case, it had to do with a small Jewish community that was at that time enough families to begin a little synagogue in an old house. Mm. And it was the first time I'd ever been to a religious service. It wasn't part of our life in New York.
We're listening to Fresh Air book critic Maureen Carrigan in conversation with poet Myra Shapiro. Shapiro's book of poems is I'll See You Thursday. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Fresh Air book critic Maureen Carrigan talking with poet Myra Shapiro.
I want to get to how you came to write this book, this first book of poetry in your 60s. You were in the South, the 50s, the 60s, raising a family, teaching,
yes.
Also working as a librarian.
Yes.
How did you come to start writing poetry?
I don't know. Certain things happened. It was the 1970s. The women's movement had happened. And I think that I wouldn't have written poetry if it hadn't been for the women's movement. Because I couldn't get it through my head that I could harness my own power. And I wasn't dumb, but there was a lack of awareness. I would read poems by Randall Jarrell. He was a person who was able to write poems in the persona of a woman. And I remember the woman at the Washington Zoo, but in particular there was a poem called Next Day, in which a woman is going down the aisles of a grocery store from, as he said, maybe I would have to recall it, from All to Joy to, here are the names of the detergents.
Mm-hmm.
That had happened to me, not in a grocery store, but I was home minding our new first baby, and watching television, and a commercial showed a woman in this gorgeous coat putting pink Dreft, it was a detergent, in the washing machine, and then leaving the house to go out wherever she was going. Oh, I thought, I would buy pink Dreft somehow. I don't know. Don't ask me how we get hooked on these fantasies, but they release us. And until we can release ourselves, maybe that's all that we have. And until the women's movement, I had found a way, going back to school, so that I could read and have permission to do that regularly, went back to school one day a week, saved my household money and got a babysitter, went back to school. For 11 years, I was a junior in college, afraid to finish because what would I have after school? Mm. And when the women's movement came along, it gave me a vision of after school. And I could complete my senior year and become a teacher. That's what I thought that would fit.
Mm.
And I did that, and I taught for years until my children were older and our younger child was ready, our younger daughter, ready to go off to college. And again, not consciously, but some knowledge I must have had about having the house to myself and the solitude that I'd need for writing. It was also around the time my mother died. I've often wondered whether that had anything to do with it. But that emotional, that hurt of my mother's death prompted me to write. And I wrote again and I wrote again. And then I realized I wanted to keep doing it. So I cut my teaching down to part-time. And when my daughter went off to school, I was writing full-time. And I knew that was what I wanted to do for the rest of my life.
Who did you show those first poems to?
I went to a conference for women writers. I saw it, an ad. Maybe it was in Ms. Magazine, I don't remember. And it was a conference in Oneonta, New York. And I guess, and that was my first writing workshop. Grace Paley happened to be a guest, Audre Lorde. I mean, this is, when you're, I have this kind of, maybe, I don't know what to call it, but this belief that when you're on your path, you're going down, and there, let's say there are gates, and the gates open. The gates, somehow you have the key. So the gates open. When I decided to come to New York because I wanted a community of other writers, I said, oh, well, you just think it's easy to do that, finding an apartment in New York, all of that. I bought the Village Voice, and the second apartment I looked at was the sublet that became mine. In every case, it's been being on my gyroscope. This writing poetry when will and desire become one.
What's so striking to me about the change you made to realize yourself as a poet and to move to New York to be, as you say, within a community of poets, is that you managed to make that change within a marriage, which I think is especially difficult. It seems from reading some of your poems that you thought at times that the marriage wouldn't survive that change. And one of your poems that I like a lot is called In Greenwich Village on Halloween We Talk of Love, because it seems to wed a recollection of a scary patch in your marriage with this goofy backdrop of the Halloween parade in Greenwich Village. Would you read that one for
us? Yes, sir. In Greenwich Village on Halloween We Talk of Love. Dearest H, you'd have roared and carried on. Hearty laugher that you are, you would have clapped to see such happiness. A high-heeled man in a silver sheath threw chocolate kisses. A woman, wrapped paper leaf, uncurled, became an undulating tongue of green snake. And an old man, who leaned as if to kiss my cheek, coughed gold dust in my face. All night I sparkled. But what I started to say before the parade got underway had to do with love, the way I love you. Waiting for the hoopla, I told my friend, I love you as the shore, the wave. Set to marry in December, she wants to talk of love, what we do that's lasting. I said, I love your going out, and I know you're coming back. As simple as that. As putting on your robe, don't laugh, to be a nun, parading with a book, with women friends, in sisterly devotion, always knowing there's another. A man, you, who gives me something else. Less intensity, touch, release, fun. But weird to think of ordinary love that way, right there on bank where we once fought about our first apartment, so scared we'd separate.
One of the things I like so much about that poem is that it talks about old love. And by that, I don't mean the people involved are that old, but that it, love that's gone on for a while. And I can't think of that many poems, novels, essays that talk about love after the big reader, I married him moment. You know, it doesn't seem to be a subject that many people have tackled in literature.
It interests me, and I hope that we'll get more poems about people who have stayed together for a long period of time, whether it's old friendship, old marriage, mm-hmm. Because people are living longer, mm-hmm. so maybe we will.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Myra Shapiro, I want to thank you so much for being my guest on Fresh Air today.
Yes.
Oh, thank you so much, Maureen.
Myra Shapiro talk with Fresh Air book critic Maureen Corrigan. Shapiro's first book of poetry, I'll See You Thursday, is published by Blue Sofa Press in St. Paul, Minnesota. This is Fresh Air.